Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and this is the last episode for the year 2019, the last episode for the decade. What did you do with your 2010s? I did this. In just a minute, we'll be walking through all the week's security news with Adam Boileau, and then it will be on to this week's sponsor interview with Haroon Mir of Thinkst Canary. Haroon is more than a sponsor, though, you know. I mean, he's practically a podcast family, let's put it that way. So I'm thrilled that he'll be joining us for the last sponsor interview of the year, indeed the last interview of the year. And we're going to do the typical thing that people like to do in December and have a look forward to what we can expect to see in security in the new year. But we're going less for the big dumb predictions like that the IoTs are coming, you know, stuff like that, and more picking the trends that we expect to strengthen over the next year or so. That is fun stuff, and it is coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a look back at the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, the first few stories we're going to talk about today really have to do with this balkanization trend that we've been seeing a lot of in recent years. The first story here announces that China is set to move technology spend away from foreign firms when it comes to government systems. They're trying to eliminate foreign systems from government networks.
Yeah, this does seem to be a pretty big move by the Chinese government. And it sounds like they want to ditch Windows and, associated, Western origin tech from their entire government, which, on the one hand, I doesn't seem like a terrible idea. I'm sure all of the concerns that we've had about supply chain, and we talked about this, I think, last week, are kind of amplified when you're running Windows, when you're running Office,
It occurred to me, too, when I read this, that you'd said that last week, which is like, if you think you've got supply chain problems, try being China or Russia.
Yeah, exactly right. So, I don't think I'm surprised here. But, of course, what this actually means long term, the idea that we would have, not only, separate bits of the network in the way that the Chinese Great Firewall does, but separate operating systems, potentially separate hardware, eventually even separate architectures. You could imagine this diverging so far that we don't even have, ARM architecture or x86 architecture, on the other side of the Great Wall. So,
well, there's a lot we can't access already because so much of the Chinese internet is V6.
Yeah, well, exactly right. The network already introduces a bunch of these things, but there's separate app ecosystems and separate search engines, all that sort of logical further up. But it's just like, we don't really know what the consequences are going to be of not even having a common architecture if we end up going that way. It's a pretty big deal. And if you're a Microsoft shareholder or anyone else that, sells big amounts of software, HP and Dell and selling hardware and software into China, maybe it doesn't look so good for you. But on the other hand, this is going to have to go the other way eventually, right? All of the hardware that gets made in China.
Yeah.
We're going to end up having to fab in the West. So, I don't know how. I feel like maybe the Chinese have the easier road there because, let's face it, taking up some Linux distro and kind of Chinesifying it a bit and trying to shore that up from a supply chain perspective, maybe that's easier than building your own chip fabs. I don't know.
Well, what's interesting too is they are planning their own OS for government use, but they've got the Chinese military behind it. But I sort of wonder what happens, and I think I mentioned that at the time that they announced they were going to do that, is I kind of wonder if they're actually going to succeed in making usable Linux on the desktop. You might actually wind up with a really good OS out of this.
That was the joke around the office is what comes after the year of the pig. Well, the year of Linux on the desktop. But on the other hand, right, this would be really interesting because, if we took Windows out of China or out of Russia, if this kind of continued in the way and we ended up with a world that's kind of partitioned along geopolitical lines, then the vuln equities process is going to become a bit more straightforward, right? All of those sweet Windows, kernel remotes that the NSA is sitting on, all of a sudden they can just go patch them. Give them over to Microsoft because they don't have to worry about it.
Boom tish.
Right? Because it's just going to be a whole bunch easier when you don't have to worry about protecting.
Well, I think the VEP example becomes more stark when you're looking at, you got a bug in, Chinese government Linux. I don't think that one's ever going to get patched. Can you see NSA reporting bugs in PRC Linux to them? Yeah. I don't think so.
No, exactly. And so it does, in some ways, it will simplify things. And I imagine if you were NSA, you'd be looking at this and going, that's pretty good. We'd be quite happy about that because you've got a much clearer target. And obviously, Microsoft and a bunch of the companies that have spent a lot of time getting security right. You're going to screw up security the first 14 times that you do it.
Well, I wonder if it's a modified Linux distro or if they've got a shot at building something from the ground up that has potential to be quite good.
Well, I mean, maybe you end up with a, you know, like what's the one that Samsung built, like a Tizen or something, you know, starting from, you know, really old, crappy, long way back free software that turns out to be full of horrible bugs and we can all laugh at forever. So, I mean, I guess we don't know. Like, I mean, they may build an entirely competent, you know, new operating system. It may just be Linux with, you know, a desktop skin. Who knows? Either way, I think it means they're not going to benefit from all the security work that's been done by organizations like Microsoft. And, you know, I don't know that that's a net win for them.
Yeah, that's a point. Hey, while we're on the topic of China, I had a listener write in to point out that I've been mispronouncing Xinjiang as Xinjiang. So there you go. Apologies to listeners for getting that one wrong. Apparently, the correct pronunciation is closer to Xinjiang. So yes, consider me appropriately scolded on that one. But it's not just China that is, you know, in the balkanization news this week. Russia is apparently pumping $31 million into developing a local Wikipedia clone, which is the most Putin thing that I've seen in so long. You know, don't like that entry. That one needs to be a little nicer to us. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's funny the kind of the contrast, you know. In China, it's about, you know, controlling the tools of the state, and in Russia, it's about
controlling the image of the state.
Controlling the image of the state, right? Which is a very sort of you know, Russian sort of thing. But yeah, it sounds like they, you know, eventually are keen to throw Wikipedia out of the network in Russia. They've given a whole bunch of money, some, you know, like billion rubles or something, to an existing Russian encyclopedia. I presume they made like print encyclopedias, and they currently have an internet-based one. So they've been given a whole bunch of funding to beef that up and write more nice articles about, you know, Putin and friends. And, you know, eventually once that's, you know, kind of worthwhile enough, then, yeah, presumably we'll just see them ditch Wikipedia at the border.
Yeah, probably. And Huawei is actually suing the US FCC too, because they're like, you just designated us as a security risk and harmed our business and denied us due process. Wah, wah, wah. And they're going to sue them. Don't know how well they're going to go with this.
No. I mean, on the other hand, they've got to give it a go, right? I mean, that's what the American legal system's for. And yeah, at the very least, some lawyers will probably get rich. But yeah, I don't know where this is going to head. But I guess they have to try to at least keep up pretenses, even if there's no expectation that it's going to go anywhere. They've still got to give it a go. And besides, I mean, the American FCC are kind of lately. So yeah, I'm kind of happy to see them getting sued, even if it's, you know, in the big picture, Huawei could probably just knob off.
Yeah, Amazon's suing the US government too over losing the Jedi contract to Microsoft. And, you know, people love to sue when things go bad in the old US of A. We got a great report here by Joel Shetman and Christopher Bing at Reuters. And of course, these were the two journalists who brought us the news of Project Raven over the year. This is a big feature that looks back to the origins of Project Raven when it was called something different, and also looks at the role of various senior former US security officials in setting up this surveillance capability for the UAE. The name that really jumps out in this report is Richard Clarke.
Yeah, now this is a really interesting story about how we ended up in that kind of, you know, Project Raven story that they broke, you know, 6 months ago. You know, looking back at the history of cyber capability in the UAE, and yeah, the fact that it came out of, you know, a bunch of previously really highly placed officials in the US government, Richard Clarke being, as you say, like the big one, following 9/11, you know, when there was a real, you know, desire to go after terrorists and, you know, allies in the Middle East that were, you know, willing to fight, you know, to help with American counterterrorism were, you know, particularly valued. They went into the UAE and helped them build up the capability to do the cybers, you know, for the purpose of targeting terrorists. And here, you know, here we are 10 years later or so, and it's turned into a tool that's being used for, you know, oppressing journalists and just, you know, targeting all of the Qatari government and you know, who else, anyone else who kind of gets in the way of the UAE government. It's an interesting story because of the ties to, you know, previous high-ups from the US government and, of course, defense contracts and people who've been involved in NSA, as well as, of course, staff that have come out of, you know, the US intelligence apparatus ending up, you know, just in a foreign government, you know, hacking Americans, it turns out, in places.
Yeah, I think this is interesting. And you and I were just talking before we started recording because, you know, everything that's sort of transpired from this point, right, where you got Richard Clarke, who is, you know, as best I can tell, would have been seriously motivated to harm groups like Al-Qaeda, right, in that region, right? So that would have been a big motivation, as well as piles of money, right? But it would have been a big part of the motivation for him to help set up that capability. And, you know, post 9/11, in countries like Australia, the United States, New Zealand, we were all quite worried that this surveillance capability would wind up being used to do things like the things that are happening in the UAE now, you know, going after journalists, activists, things like that. It didn't quite turn out that way in the West, but, you know, in other places, it did. And this is one of those examples, isn't it? It's like this alternative timeline of what could have been here.
Yeah, well, it really illustrates how transportable the tools and the techniques and the approaches are, and the fact that you can use them, you know, can very much use them for all these things. And it also kind of underlines the fact that, you know, the fact that we haven't used them that way so much in the West, you know, that we're kind of getting at least some things right. I mean, the oversight is somewhat useful, and that, you know, we are, you know, we're not as bad as we could be.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, when you see, you know, people who used to work for the American NSA, you know, running operations like this in other countries, as it turns out, not entirely with the approval of their own government, it seems. That's, you know, it kind of underscores how important it is to keep a handle and, you know, to keep oversight and to keep, you know, this stuff in check so that it doesn't end up, you know, being used to what is very tempting in some cases, you know, being able to just go, I don't like this report, or I don't like this, you know, what bid to win the Soccer World Cup or whatever it was that Qatar got that the Emiratis didn't like. I mean, just being able to use it willy-nilly. This is, you know, a thing we've managed to hopefully keep a little bit in check.
Yeah, yeah. Facebook, meanwhile, is pushing ahead with plans to implement end-to-end encryption despite pressure from the Department of Justice in the United States. This is an interesting dilemma, this one, because, of course, we all love our E2Es, but, you know, the scale of stuff like child exploitation material and grooming and stuff like that on the Facebook platform is, you know, I mean, the scale is mind-boggling, and this certainly has potential to put a ding in some safety efforts. So it's a complex discussion, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, this has always been the story with crypto and the way that it gets used. You know, that there is a dual, you know, there's dual use for it, and there's risks that come in both directions. I mean, I would have thought that, I mean, surely if you're doing child exploitation, you wouldn't be using Facebook Messenger. But I guess
people no. But I'm talking about people like grooming kids and stuff. You know, yeah. Like this is a thing. This is how they do it.
Yeah, I mean, it is really hard, right? Because there isn't a straightforward answer, right? On the one hand, we have all of the bad things that people do. And then on the other hand, we have, you know, the difficulties of actually implementing technically backdoor access or decryption access or key escrow or whatever it is in a way that's actually good. And we haven't really found one yet, right? And that's the challenge that, you know, Facebook and Google and Apple and, you know, other vendors are
being shoved,
having their noses rubbed in, I guess.
Interesting you say, because there was a Senate hearing today, I believe, or overnight, in the United States looking at this topic. I got some audio here from that hearing where we had a Apple person, a Facebook person, you know, who's basically the head of Messenger product security and privacy. And also Matt Tate was there. I'm going to play some audio here where the Facebook guy is saying, oh, you know, this is all very complex. And then you'll hear the response from Senator Lindsey Graham. Another interesting feature of this hearing was the tech companies were kind of being attacked by both Republicans and Democrats. There seems to be a real bipartisan hunger to get something done here. But just have a listen to this clip.
I think this is a very complicated technical topic.
Well, it ain't complicated for me. You're going to find a way to do this, or we're going to do it for you. We're not going to live in a world where a bunch of child abusers can have a safe haven to practice their craft. Period. End of discussion. You're either the solution or you're the problem. Having said that, I appreciate all you're doing to protect our data, our privacy. I don't want people listening to my phone calls or reading my messages. I get all of that. But being an American, I also don't want a situation where criminals can exploit this technology to hide behind it and do all kind of dastardly things to kids and maybe the country itself. So I've been following this for a year. My advice to you is to get on with it. Because this time next year, if we haven't found a way that you can live with, we will impose our will on you.
Now, it doesn't get much more stark than that, does it, Adam?
Yeah, it's pretty unequivocal. It's if that's where we're going to end up, you know, a year from now, they decide that they're just going to, you know, issue some edict. Then, we'll see how that, I guess we'll have to see how well, that plays look, out. I mean, you understand the frustrations, I guess, that they have, right, with the tech companies.
Yeah, I do. And I think it's interesting when you've got a politician who just says, oh, it's complicated, is it? I don't care, right? And that's kind of, and that's kind of where we are. But I also think that the tech companies, and, you know, people have heard me being critical of the tech companies, right? And they think that I'm some pro-law enforcement shill or whatever. But I do think they can do more. They can do more. If they want to avoid the regulation hammer, they're going to have to meet halfway and maybe set up a nice little secure basement room where they can do unlocks and brute force pins.
I mean, you're right. I mean, they do have options, and they're going to have to come up with something that's palatable to society as a whole, because otherwise they're going to get hit with, you know, whatever, I don't know, whatever sort of crazy banhammer Lindsey Graham would come up with, or, you know, any of the other American government. I mean, all sorts of, if you don't care, like, about what's complex and you're just willing to say it's going to be like this, then, yeah, I guess they could do anything.
Yeah, fix it or else seems to be the position now of, and, you know, he's not some junior politician, right? That's the other thing that makes this noteworthy. I just have a feeling that we are actually going to see some movement on this in 2020. I feel like it's been quiet for a while, and yeah, it's going to happen. And I think the tech companies need to maybe not play such a double game on this. I think it's dangerous, and I think we're all going to wind up in a worse spot if they just dig in like this, right? That's always been my position. Now, what else have we got here? Oh yeah, Apple. Actually, speaking of Apple, they issued a DMCA takedown notice against a Twitter user who posted a decryption key that would allow anyone to decrypt a specific version of Apple's iOS firmware, which would mean that they could get copies. Unencrypted copies of SEP so that they could then do like reverse engineering and stuff on that. It caused a huge stir, and then they backed down, and now that tweet is back on the internet. But it certainly feels like Apple's kind of gone to war against security researchers a bit lately.
Yeah, it does seem like rather a blunt, blunt instrument to try and Streisand some crypto keys off the network. And, you know, whether or not you'd be able to then get good, good security research having access to that firmware. I would imagine a lot of people who are doing this stuff already have access in terms of overall big picture impact, I'm not sure what like that particular set of key material was worth the fight. On the other hand, I guess they don't want to set a precedent where you can just, dump their key material and they go, oh, well, okay, fine. But yeah, Apple does seem to be a bit, kind of lumbering around the place a little bit lately between this and, Corellium and, a few other things.
Yeah, that's it. Reddit has said that a leak of US-UK trade negotiation documents that appeared on Reddit was part of a Russian influence operation.
Well, I'm not exactly surprised. I mean, the trope of stealing a bunch of documents and then dropping them somewhere to try and influence political discourse or sow unrest or whatever, that's firmly out of the Russian playbook. Reddit says that they had associated the particular user account and some of the activity with other campaigns that they've seen, that people have seen attempting to influence elections around the place.
Yeah, I think I saw it a couple other firms come out and say, yeah, we know these guys.
It's part of an existing Russian a Russian campaign. We saw the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab linking it to a Russian program called Secondary Infection, which is trying to just generally destabilize Western politics with all sorts of influence campaigns around the place. And we did see that this one wasn't super effective. I mean, the particular document didn't get a whole bunch of traction in the UK, as far as I can tell from international reporting. Compared to some of the other Russian influence campaigns, which seem to be a bit more effective. But yeah, I'm sure within its niche, some people paid a bit of attention, and yeah, kind of, I guess it's good that Reddit did something. I mean, it's not normally what you'd expect from them.
We have some info here on Evil Corp, which is apparently the group of hackers behind Drydex. We got an indictment here. I think the guy is he's been indicted in absentia, but authorities have released all sorts of pictures of these guys like living the high life, driving around in their Lamborghinis, wearing awful clothes. Like, they got money, but no taste, like bad haircuts and getting a Lamborghini and painting it in a camo like color.
Neon camouflage.
Jeez, guys, come on. So get some style, will you? But this is interesting, right, that we're seeing charges against someone involved in Drydex, which of course is, that stuff's everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, this guy's been involved, at least in the Drydex banking trojan, but also providing money laundering support for a bunch of the other things. I think one of the big crews that was pushing Zeus was using this guy's money laundering network, or there was some other tie-up between the Zeus trojan and this guy. Tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars worth of money kind of moved through stolen accounts from compromised machines. There's also suggestion that this guy's been involved with the FSB and providing access to Russian government to systems that have been compromised by their existing kind of crime operations. So I don't know if this guy's going to get let out of Russia to get arrested in the near future, given how much of a fight they put up over the other guy that we were talking about a few weeks ago getting extradited to the US from Israel. I think this guy's probably confined to his luxury dacha in the Russian hinterlands for the meantime.
Let's see if he's dumb enough to take a holiday to Thailand next year, because they all seem to do it eventually, right?
They do eventually. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Got to go sit in the sun. Can't just go to the Black Sea and eat caviar. You got to go somewhere else.
That's it. Earlier this year, this podcast reported that Ocean Lotus, the Vietnamese APT crew, were behind the attack against Toyota Australia. It looks like BMW and Hyundai also got the Ocean Lotus treatment recently.
Yeah, it sounds like the Vietnamese government is, you know, looking for some help with its domestic vehicle industry, and had has been going around a bunch of places, you know, Toyota, BMW, Hyundai, who knows, however many the other auto manufacturers. If you hit three, you may as well hit the rest, right? So I'm sure they're all getting their, you know, data hosed up, and yeah, maybe we'll see the rise of the Vietnamese industry.
100 dental offices, over 100 dental offices have been ransomwared. We've also got the city of Pensacola having trouble. A so-called cyber attack has crippled the city, officials have said. We've also got a major US data center provider, which is called CyrusOne. They have been ransomwared. I mean, this ain't going anywhere, this stuff.
No, and we've been reporting this, you know, essentially this set of stories every week for what, like it seems like 2 years now. Although, I mean, the focus on big targets and, I mean, things like healthcare and what was the aged care one we talked about last week before. Like that's just, it's really nasty, and yet it kind of makes sense in a way, because, I mean, those are the sorts of organizations that, you know, are just not really going to invest in good IT. And then the outsource providers are just always going to be driven by cost. And, you know, I was reading the comments actually on Krebs's piece about this, where there's a bunch of people saying, oh, well, dentists are the worst, you know, at computer security. And then somebody else is like, well, no, doctors are the worst. No, you know, any specialist practice, you know, lawyers, accountants, doctors, you know, whoever it is, they're all terrible because all computers are terrible and all security is terrible. And that's...
well, that's very helpful commentary. Adam, thank you so much. Very insightful. Very, very insightful. Look, you're going to hear in this week's sponsor interview that I talked to Haroon about this, because my trend for next year is like, that I've identified is around this ransomware stuff, but I think we need to change our thinking of it, right? Because our traditional understanding of ransomware was like drive-by downloads, you know, nasty attachments, document exploits, things like that. Really, what I think ransomware has become is it's just a monetization part that comes at the end of a full compromise. Okay, so that's the that's the shift in thinking that we need. It's not a ransomware attack. It's a full domain compromise that uses ransomware to monetize that compromise. Does that make sense?
At the end.
At the end, right? You go in, you own the crap out of them. Roll like you do, right? Do like Insomnia does. Go in, own everything, get domain admin, and then ransomware the lot after you've nuked the backups. That's what this is going to look like next year.
Yeah, I mean, and for clarity, we don't do that last bit.
No, you don't.
But no, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a thing, it's a monetization technique. And that's, you know, where we saw crypto mining, you know, pushing a whole bunch of compromises of you know, like shared web hosting and anything where you get free hosting. People were then just leveraging that to run miners. Like, this is the same sort of thing, right? It's just the easiest way to get money quickly out of a compromised environment. And I mean, we've seen people do other things, right? Sell off access to individual boxes, you know, to people who want to buy it, you know, use it as proxy networks, use it for, you know, running your NordVPN, well, according to what the story we had a couple of weeks ago. So yeah, there's plenty of ways to try and monetize it, but just ransomware has turned out to be really effective, you know, on this type of organization that doesn't have good, you know, IT practice and can't restore from backups. And you're right, we'll see them move to cripple the backups first, right? If you have to wait 6 months, make sure all the backups are ruined first and then roll your ransomware up, like that's, you know, the kind of the next step.
Yeah, it is, right? So, yay, 2020. Exit scamitis is spreading, Adam. This is hilarious. This story. I mean, it's not even technically a security story, but we've got to talk about it.
Yeah, this is, there's some reports of a group of like really low cost virtual host providers, like low cost VPS providers, all shutting down at once. It turned out to be some kind of rat's nest of essentially the same backend platform being sold with a bunch of different brand names. And they've all shut down and said, you know, all your machines going to get turned off next week. You've got a couple of days to get all your data off. And it sounds like the scam that people are saying is going on here is that it's a, like they ran a whole bunch of promotions during the like stupid Cyber Monday Black Friday. What even is that? And then, you know, sold people, you know, you can get a year's hosting for this much money and then just shut down the next week and take their money. It seems to be the scam. Yeah.
That's it. So it's like, it's 10 bucks a month, you know, or you can pay $100 for a year and then, they sign up a bunch of people and then just pull the pin, right? So
seems kind of smart.
Sure, why not, you know? Why not? Keybase is having some trouble. This has been going on a while. It looks like they're trying to get on top of it, but essentially they're like Keybase has just become unusable because of spam and bots and all sorts of stuff, right? And they're saying, oh, we're going to get on top of it. But I don't know, man, it sort of feels like the horse has bolted on this. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you certainly get the impression that, I mean, the value that Keybase gave people, you know, in terms of being able to do keys and identities, which is kind of where it started. And then all of the other features they crammed onto it, you know, as the user base grew, for most people, what they actually wanted it for isn't worth the grief of now having to deal with the spamming and the other things that are going wrong for the platform. And, you know, I mean, PGP, that kind of key management ecosystem, identity management ecosystem, I don't know, there's very many people who are that interested in it anymore. You know, there's kind of bigger fish to fry. And I don't, you know, it does make me wonder, like, what percentage of the user base is just going to table flip and delete it, you know, walk out, not use it anymore, forget about it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you've seen tweets over the last few weeks of people just walking away, you know, and that's the context in which we see this story.
Yeah, I mean, this story from Ars Technica actually talks about Lee Hutchinson from Ars just going, this is not even worth my time to even think about this. I don't care about Keybase. Forget about it. It's gone.
I've seen others, right? Like, it's a thing. This one's kind of like, I shouldn't laugh, but some Chinese venture capitalists got fleeced for $1 million in a BEC scam.
Yeah, the scammers in this case set up some fake domain names very close to both the Chinese venture capital firm and the company that they were trying to steal, who are going to get funded, and were like man-in-the-middling both sides with their fake domain names and then sending emails back and forward. And yeah, eventually managed to redirect a payment of $1 million and walk off with it, which pretty smooth operation.
Smooth operation. Facebook is suing a company based in Hong Kong that it ran some sort of like ad platform malware hybrid where it would drop malware on Facebook users that would get access to their account and spread ads, which would drop more malware, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're suing.
Yeah, well, that seems fair. I guess Facebook's always got dodgy ads on the platform, and you know, it takes a long time to go after each one individually. But I mean, they're sort of plodding ever onwards, you know, taking a few here and there. But I don't know whether this is enough.
Yeah, well, you know, and the very next story is that they've fired a employee. Although I've seen subsequent corrections to this coverage indicating that the person was in fact a contractor, but it's kind of splitting hairs in the late capitalist system, isn't it? Whether or not someone's a contractor or an employee, but someone working for Facebook was fired because they were taking thousands of dollars in bribes to reactivate banned ad accounts. So yeah, that's not a good look.
No, and actually it wasn't very much money, you know, not very many thousands. Like, the guy was making about $3,000 a month or something to just kind of unban advertising campaigns. I guess it's easy money, $1,000 for a click, $3,000 for a click.
Well, and it depends what they're paying these people as well. Like, I don't think everyone in tech is working, you know, is getting paid fat cash, you know?
No, I suppose. I mean, I guess, $3,000 a month is, you know, that's some good pocket money for just clicking a checkbox here and there and, you know, unbanning someone's ad account, so...
Yeah, what else have we got? I think this was announced a while ago, but Google Chrome is now going to warn you if your passwords have been stolen, because they've assembled their own sort of "Have I Been Pwned" equivalent, and you know, they're integrating that with Chrome, which is just a good thing in this day and age. Oh, last week we spoke about how Avast and AVG plugins were stealing users' like web browsing habits and like sending them off, and we thought, you know, maybe that's a mistake. It turns out, Adam.
It's a business model. Yes, Avast actually does harvest its users' like web click stream data and then bundles it up and sells it. Apparently they own or part own a company, 65% own a company that runs like analytics for people's browsing habits, and just flogs it off. Like makes, I think they said something like 5% of their revenue is from this particular part of their business. So, you know.
I think it's going to cost them a little bit more than 5% of their revenue maybe. Now people realize what it's all about, you know. So, if you're using Avast, I don't know, what is this, like a toolbar or something, or like browser plugin, just get rid of it. They have lost their credibility. We got a couple of malicious Python libraries here that have been stealing SSH and GPG keys. They're just typo squatting. You know, it's nothing too sophisticated.
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty much the sort of thing we've seen in a bunch of the different language packets repositories, you know, over the last couple of years. There's been a few against the Python scene lately. But yeah, this one was just, type of squatting a couple of common names and would steal your keys. And then kind of would also steal some of the config to try and spot other projects that the users might be maintaining in the package repo so they could expand the compromise. But it looks like they got noticed.
Yeah. Catalin Campanu has a report about some malware, you know, just whatever garden variety malware, but it has a cool trick. And I'm surprised we haven't seen this trick before. We don't normally report really on neat. Stuff like this, but this is pretty cool.
This is pretty funny. Yeah, this particular set of malware that's is deploying ransomware, its trick to avoid AV is that it will reboot your box into safe mode to run itself. On the idea that your AV and other any other protective technology you have may not work in safe mode. So yeah, it just kind of sets a registry key to cause your machine to come up in safe mode and to trigger the ransomware next time. And then, yeah, just reboots and does it in safe mode, which is a brilliant engineering solution to the problem. Like, you could go to all these, you know, crazy AV evasion tricks, or you could just use safe mode. Why not?
Hacker One, or as we like to call them here on Risky Business, Hackeroni, they have had to pay a bounty out pertaining to a flaw in its own platform. And I think it's cool, right, that they've paid a good bounty for this.
They did. They paid, what, $20,000 yep. To a guy that was working on their platform, had been reporting some bugs, was in a conversation with one of their HackerOne staff members or a contractor or someone that was doing, I think, bug triage. And they were talking back and forth about it. And the HackerOne employee had pasted an example of a request that they were using via the command line curl web tool that had some session cookie material in the command line. And then the hacker could figure out, hey, I can get access to a bunch of backend HackerOne systems and read the submission queue and see all the other people's bugs and all of the, you know, not yet patched, not yet triaged security information. That seems bad. And yeah, he's right. It was bad.
Was this limited to the exposure of a single session cookie?
I believe it was a single session cookie, which then, of course, you can use to get onwards access to a bunch of other stuff. There was some argument about exactly how much stuff that was. But yeah, essentially, there was a single session cookie exposed. And yeah, after that, you know, you can get to a lot of things.
$20,000 cookie. Nice.
$20,000 cookie. Yep.
We got some more attacks against Intel chips involving fiddling with voltages being applied to the chips. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so I mean, we've seen a bunch of attacks over the years that involve, you know, kind of glitching hardware attacks on, you know, CPUs and processors to try and make them behave strangely, either through, you know, like measuring the power usage or making them glitch out by giving them not enough power or too much power or whatever else. This one's interesting because it's an attack on like mainline Intel processors rather than some obscure, you know, embedded smart card. They're targeting, in this case, things like the secure enclave on the Intel SGX, you know, kind of enclave on the Intel processors to be able to escalate access. And they're doing it in software. And that's, I think, at least from my reading of it, I'm pretty sure they're doing this with the software ability to control the voltage of the CPU. So you can compromise a machine, gain root level access on the operating system, and then use the software's control of the CPU's voltages to then trigger hardware glitching attacks. And that's pretty neat. I don't think I've seen that before. Like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, the first I heard about it was DigitalOcean sent me an email saying, we've fixed this thing, you know? So it feels like, you know, the cloud providers really do get a heads up on this stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure they do, because I mean, they're one of the cases where you do have privileged users that are mutually distrusting sharing the same hardware, and that's exactly what these kinds of bugs are for. The solution that Intel's currently pushing seems pretty drastic. It's basically just to lock the voltages down so that you can't modify them, you know, through a microcode update. And we're seeing updates from a bunch of the OEMs, you know, and I guess everybody's pretty used to pushing out Intel microcode updates after all of the side channel stuff. But yeah, it's kind of nice to see something a bit different, you know, than all of the side channel things. But yeah, this is just, it's really cool research, and the fact that it's actually practically doable is really cool. Like, you know, it's good stuff.
Adam, we're going to end this show with two stories that both deal with comedy bugs. First up, OpenBSD.
Oh dear, yes, the 90s Unix has certainly got some 90s Unix style bugs in it. Qualys really does seem to love this kind of, whoever it is down at the Qualys Security Research Team that does this stuff, clearly loves, you know, old school, you know, Unix bugs. In this particular case, they dug up several in OpenBSD that relate to authentication. The really funny one is kind of a trick, basically, where you can provide a username that looks like a parameter to some internal part of the auth processing functionality and just kind of log in without a password, which is, you know, in a distribution, you know, an operating system that's meant to be really robust and secure, a little bit embarrassing. And then that bug manifests itself in a bunch of places. But yeah, there's a bunch of other OpenBSD bugs, all of which, of course, got patched very quickly once the OpenBSD team were told about it. But it's just kind of funny, you know, seeing really, you know, classic logic bugs in authentication code showing up, you know, in OpenBSD.
Yep, in 2019 AD.
almost 2020 AD.
Almost 2020. Now, this next one, man, this is funny, right? Like, this is legit funny. And I was really surprised that it didn't get, like, more attention just because of how funny it was. It all starts with a tweet from the Swift on Security Twitter user. And apparently they had spotted a domain lookup outbound from their network for Atlassian-domain-for-localhost-connections-only.com. So Atlassian domain for localhost-connections-only.com, which resolves to 127.0.0.1. So hang on, you've got a lookup going from apparently your Confluence box, right? Going out to that domain name only to be returned a value of 127.0.0.1. Turns out that when you're using Confluence, I think there's like some helper agent on your local machine, and you know, you're in your Confluence and it wants to interact and mix content from a local service with your Confluence stuff, right? So instead of just pulling it directly from 127.0.0.1 because they don't want a mixed content warning, their solution was to hard code in a domain that exists on the internet that returns localhost as its answer, right? And then they ship it with an SSL certificate in the local service. So long story short, if you can man in, you know, if you can get in the middle of the DNS lookup, you can feed it a different IP, which is just hilarious.
I mean, it's pretty funny. And I mean, you can kind of see why they did it, right? I mean, it's one of these sorts of, you know, they're five problems deep, and in the end, they solve the problem without really thinking through what it means.
But if you go to Let's Encrypt like FAQ, like they say, you might be tempted to do X, Y, Z. Do not do this, right? It is a really bad idea.
Sometimes an engineering solution is just, you know, you just want the problem to go away and you don't want to think about it too much.
Anyway, fun stuff. And mate, that is actually it for Risky Business 2019. How was it for you?
Well, it's been quite a year, man. Lots of NatSec, lots of ransomware, lots of, you know, really hard stories in a way. You know, all of the stuff with doctors and hospitals, and it's just really it makes me feel as a, you know, tech security professional that we're miserable failures. So that's kind of, you know, a great way to end the year. But yeah, it's just, you know, it's always fun talking about what's going on. There's always new crazy stuff, and after 10 years of doing this, like, we're still being surprised by what kind of madness is happening. So, you know, there'll be plenty more as well. So that's always good.
Yeah. Yeah, 13 years for me, by the way.
Yeah. I can't remember how many years have I been doing this for?
I don't know. I think it's like 10 or 11, yeah. So it's been a while. It has been a while. Okay, man. Well, that's it for the year. I'm sure you and I will exchange the odd message over the next little while, but we'll be back. We're going to be back on January 8, Australia time, with a show featuring Alex Stamos, because you have that week off, and I hope it is a very relaxing, enjoyable time for you. And then you'll be back on the show on the 15th, so looking forward to it.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan, and I will look forward to hearing all the terrible things that happen between now and then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news headlines. Big thanks to Adam for that, and huge thanks to him for all of his work on the show, not just this year, but over the decade. Okay, it is time for the last interview of the year now with Haroon Mir. This is a sponsor interview. Haroon is the founder and big cheese over at Thinxt Canary. Thinxt makes simple deception software that has a simple goal. It can reduce your mean time to incident detection from a couple of years to a couple of days. You buy their honeypots, you configure and deploy them in a few minutes, and bang, you've got yourself a really nice bit of peace of mind. You know, if someone gets onto your network, you might actually have a shot at detecting them before they can move laterally and cause you real problems. So check out Canary at canary.tools. And yeah, they've got virtual honeypots as well, and they offer both free and commercial Canary token services. All very, very smart stuff. Now, Haroon, you know, he's been in security for a long time. He was an early employee of SensePost in South Africa. He's spoken at conferences all over the world. He's a super smart guy. And I spoke to him the other day about what we can expect to see in 2020 in DeCybers. Before we recorded the interview, though, we both went away and picked a few things that we think will be big next year. And then we came together for this conversation. Apologies in advance, too. There's a few crackles on this audio, not much I can do about it. But yeah, number one on Haroon's list of future security drama is software supply chain issues. And here's what he had to say about that.
When we spoke at Black Hat a few years ago, we called it the Bob Ippolito problem. Like there's this dude called Bob Ippolito who manages and maintains Simple JSON, the Python library. And when I took that screenshot for that talk, like, it was downloaded 17 million times the previous month. And so there's all these people in the world who depend on Bob Ippolito but don't factor him into their risk models at all. Like, is he 2FAing Does he still care? Like, does he go and sell his PayPal account for $100 to someone else who now has access to 17 million machines a month? And I think conceptually it's a thing that people haven't wrapped their heads around yet. Like the old software is eating the world thing basically just meant that there's a squillion developers pulling in libraries for completely arbitrary things, right? The famous one was left shift.
Yeah, that was hilarious, yeah. And the guy just rage quit and pulled it, right?
Like that's what happened. And that stuff's just everywhere. Like with the speed that people are having to develop, they're just pulling in libraries for everything.
See, it's funny because this is one that I feel like, you know, I've been on to this one because of an interview I did with Vericode like 10 years ago. And it was interesting, you know, because Vericode created their code scanning technology. And one of the things that they noticed once their tech started getting good was they noticed, okay, because they had generic detections for various issues, they'd find bugs in all of this software and they'd trace them back to these original libraries. And they're like, oh, pretty much everything is recycled from these 10 libraries. I mean, I'm exaggerating the numbers, but you get saying, right? And it's just the manifestation of that same problem 10 years later, right? Like it's not a new vulnerability, but the fact that people are starting to move on it, that's the new bit.
Yeah, I think people are starting to move on it, and I think we're just churning out more and more code faster and faster.
But from the same base blocks, right? The same building blocks.
Poison root. Yeah. So I think it's going to be a problem. And I think an extension on that we've seen some signs of that I think are going to get increasingly worse is like we've seen cases of, okay, there's this well-used ad blocker. And what happens is the ad blocker then gets a basquillion users. And the ad blocker then sells to a company that actually sells ads. And this concept of becoming an extension, becoming a trusted extension, and then selling is not something that we've almost got mental frameworks for. So you see it with the extensions. We've done some work. So we're about to release a new token. One of our guys, Jason, has done work making a Slack API token. So if essentially you find the Slack API key, but much like our AWS API key, the moment someone uses it, you get an alert to tell you someone's used it, which is pretty cool. And part of doing it, we said, well, let's look at whether Slack API keys are exposed in the wild. And sure enough, there's some sitting on GitHub. But what's more interesting is if you ponder that Slack has an entire app store. And so now there's all these Slack extensions. Wish your colleagues happy birthday. Send your colleagues mail. Post directly to Trello.
This app only requires full unfettered access to your Slack instance, right?
Exactly. Now that's the sort of thing that people are not thinking too hard about. You give it permission and then you forget about it.
So you're saying it's more of like the old, you know, Google OAuth issues, but mixed in with some supply chain issues as well.
Yeah, exactly, you know, right. Yeah. Because everyone wants to be a platform. And as soon as you want to be a platform, you're enabling this third-party content to have access to data.
That's what makes it a platform, right? As opposed to just a service.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And I think there's trouble waiting to be milked in there that we're starting to see pop up, and I think will get worse.
Now, one of the other things you mentioned was that you think, you know, trust and safety stuff, abuse stuff, those sorts of teams, they're going to see some real growth next year. That made me think of course, Alex Stamos's 2017 keynote at Black Hat, where he made that pitch. But it does feel like we've reached a tipping point, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's interesting. And I also think in some ways it's an evolution of security as a role.
That was exactly, you know, I'm sorry to go back to it, but that was exactly his whole keynote, right? Was saying like, we've got to take ownership of this. This belongs in security.
Yeah, so it's interesting. It belongs to security, but in a way it's also security belongs to it because it's end of the year and we need
No, I'm with you because it's all about dealing with problems at scale, right? So it's
exactly. And there's an interesting thing that pops out of it. So the other day I ended up watching a video from Jason Chan of Netflix and he's super smart and he runs their cloud security team. I think he's the VP of engineering now. But when he gave the talk, he was talking about abuse at Netflix. And one of the most interesting things is when you hear his talk, the entire talk goes by, and he's talking holistically about Netflix as a business. So he's a security guy, and he's not talking about where we can get owned or where we've got OWASP issue number 10.
He's talking about we lost 100 million last year exactly. Through platform abuse, and that was down from 200 million the year before.
Exactly right. Yeah. So now his whole focus is on what actually matters to us. Well, what matters is when Bob shares his password with 10 people and we only expected him. And the interesting thought that comes out of that leads then to, okay, credential stuffing is a problem for us because this is how people get more accounts. But it's a move away from security for security's sake and here's how my company is abused. And here's the detection we need to build around it. And,
It's also balancing that with consumer expectations because I'm a subscriber to Netflix and a bunch of other streaming services, and they're the YOLO ones, man. They're the ones where, you know, members of my family can be back here watching TV. I might be traveling for work or something, and I've got no problem firing it up on my iPad, on my iPhone, you know. Like, Netflix never says go away. I think, you know, by the time you're getting booted out of your Netflix account, you've shared it with a few people, right?
It's exactly that. And what's so interesting to me is when you watch the talk, now he's obviously really good at what he does, but when you watch the talk, the thing that you become aware of is this sort of coupling with the security interest and the company's interest, because he's exactly aware of that thing, which says, well, we could just lock everything down, but that's not how you become Netflix. That thing was missing from lots of corp security people who are managing networks. So they'd go, yes, we need to lock down everyone's windows, but that's not what the company is there for.
I mean, I sort of feel like we're, you know, we got to be careful not to go too far down that abuse.
Not to slam them.
Well, not to go too far down the abuse people are right path, right? Because they're fighting a fire. They're fighting a forest fire, right? You know, you get more pumps and hoses and, you know, it's a constant firefight. Whereas I think, you know, InfoSec teams looking after the crown jewels, as we call them, you know, for them, they're trying to prevent a nuclear strike, right? Like, it's a slightly different sort of scenario.
I hear it, but one of my old complaints that I've shared on the show for many years is when, like, back when we were breaking into networks, you'd break into networks and you'd find that their security team did lots of point things correctly. So they bought the X, they installed the X, they do the Y.
But they didn't have the big picture, yeah.
Yeah, that says, can we break in and transfer money? And the answer is yes. And my take is that these abuse people look at what hurts us and how can we stop it. And I think there's maybe learning that needs to go back to Corp InfoSec that's closer along those lines that says, well, what needs to be on this network and how does it get abused? How does it's a move away from, yes, here's the top 10 that we need to watch for, closer towards how is this going to hurt us? And how do we stop that? How do we detect when it's hurting us?
I think that's an interesting conversation. I mean, obviously, we can't have that full conversation because we'd be here for 3 hours. Another thing that you think is on the cards for next year is just, like, shed loads more InfoSec cons. But you don't think that's going to be the end of the world?
Yeah. Again, it's maybe end of the year being all navel-gazing. Well, the one thing is, look, it's insane. Like, in 2010, we thought we were cute because we did this graphic on how security conferences had grown. And like my catchphrase was that there's a security conference for almost every day of the year.
Yeah, now it's like, every 10 seconds or something.
we're getting to it. Like in a recent talk, Adrian checked the numbers and like you get 19 on a single day.
Yeah.
Like B-sides alone is more than nearly 600 in the year.
But let me guess, you think it's good because it's sharing the love, more people, more accessible, build, grow, that sort of thing? Kumbaya, my friend?
No, so not quite kumbaya, because you'll remember like way back when I did my InfoSec talk, like I was a big pusher for better research, let's publish better, let's not get caught up in the hype. And at this point, I think that horse has bolted. Like I think what some of the old men screaming at clouds have to come to accept is that InfoSec in some ways is a different world. Like when you used to go to Black Hat in the early 2000s, almost everyone was a researcher. And then it became everyone who was super dedicated to it. And now there's a lot of people who went into InfoSec because their class in accounting was full. And it's not the end of the world. Like, the field is big. There's a lot of people in it. And I think the
I've met these days, and this is new. You meet people who have zero passion for it, but are still very good at it. Right?
Yeah,
and it's
like,
you're a strange breed. Haven't met you before. But, you know, they're around now, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. It's like a completely different, like, it's not someone going because they're fascinated and want to hear Helva push the limits. It's someone who does this for a job and they focus on their KPIs and they deliver at the end of every year. And
I thought it'd be a good career, and here I am. It's okay. It's a job.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's something to be done still. Like, one of the things you keep hearing on all the different Slacks is people will say, oh, we submitted for X con, didn't get accepted. The solution is, let's do our own con. And you see that stuff just growing, where people just go, we should do this own limited seating thing. And effectively, you're just adding more cons. I think fundamentally, you're going to see more and more people publish differently. Like we're trying to encourage all our friends, everyone internally, to write more. Like, if I mentioned this new token that we built, we'll release it shortly, but instead of taking it to a con, we'll just YouTube it and we'll just blog it, because I'm not sure that security conferences.
So you're not saying there's going to be more cons and that's a good thing. You're saying there's going to be more cons, but that doesn't matter because people are going to start doing other stuff as well.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm saying there's more cons. It's now a different thing. And maybe if you're going to put your message out, maybe cons are not the best way to do it anymore.
All right. So I want to run through a couple of my predictions for next year, because I want to see what you think of them. We are really pressed for time here. So this section is going to be quite brief. I think ransomware has basically already turned into a way to monetize a manual compromise. So whereas ransomware used to be spammed out and, you know, drive-by downloads and things like that, those days are kind of gone. These days it's like, wow, if I can spearfish this person, maybe get some VPN creds, they haven't used 2FA, I can, you know, then move laterally, get full domain admin, and then bang, I'm going to ransomware that entire enterprise after I've already nuked their backups. And that's now my business model. What do you think?
Yeah, it's got to come. Like, it's just such an attractive way to monetize once you've got access.
Yeah.
And like you say, it's DR should be springing up all over the place.
Well, that was the other thing. Yeah, I think there's going to be a bigger focus on DR, lots more DR projects, maybe even some innovation there. I also think that social media account takeovers and ransoms are going to be a big thing next year, because I've seen them picking up in velocity towards the end of this year. Right?
Yeah,
that's crazy.
It seems the Saudis are making it big. Like finally Saudi Arabia leads cyber and technology on something.
It's not just them, and it's not just the state-backed people. I even helped someone get their account back. They had their account stolen. The attacker was trying to ransom it back to them. They were just a criminal, but they understood the recovery flows so well that they were able to obstruct this person from getting their account back. It's really quite amazing.
That's interesting.
And I guess, yeah, my other two on this list aren't that even that particularly interesting. But those three, I think they're a pretty good bet. I mean, I think I'm kind of a little bit
stable.
The ransomware one's a little bit too safe, isn't it? Because we've already seen that. I just think we're going to see more of that next year as people realize, hey, I can do hacking. Here's a way to make money out of hacking. That's what I think. It's going to be spectacular. What do you think?
I think it's got to come. Like it seems perfectly reasonable. It seems like you're basically taking something that's valuable that's maybe not protected that well. So it makes perfect sense. Interestingly, for the account takeover stuff, it's one of those where the platforms can do a little better. Like, remote account recovery at scale is tough. But maybe you can start pushing people the moment accounts start getting influential enough. Like, you start enforcing 2FA, you start enforcing certain hygiene, and you'll probably save yourself pain down the line.
I'll just say this one thing I'll say, Instagram's account recovery flows are absolutely appalling and they need to get their shit together, okay? I'm just saying this because I had some experience recently just trying to help that person get their account back, and it's the second time in the last few years, and they've really got some work to do there. Haroon, that's actually it for this week's sponsor interview, my friend, and indeed, that's it for Risky Business for 2019. It's been amazing having you on board. You're a real listener favorite. I always enjoy chatting to you, my friend. And we'll be continuing that into 2020. So all the thanks in the world, man. Chat to you soon.
Always super cool. Chat soon, Pat.
That was Haroon Mir of Thinkst Canary there. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Thinkst for its support of the Risky Business podcast. I am thrilled to announce that Thinkst will be with us again next year. And that is it for this week's show, and that is it for the year, for the decade. Thanks to everyone for their help over the last year. The Risky Business commercial manager, Tieran Ferrier, big thanks to him. He's done an amazing job handling the commercial side of the business, placing sponsors and handling sales, coordinating with them, scheduling interviews and helping determine topics and things like that, doing the invoicing, the admin, helping out with news aggregation, grant applications, you name it, he does it. So huge thanks to Tieran for basically running the business these days. Big thanks again to Adam, of course, for being a very funny and smart and knowledgeable and wonderful co-host. And thanks also to his stand-ins, guest co-hosts Alex Stamos and Mark Piper. Thanks to Mrs. Biz for production support, to the sponsors for paying the bills, and most of all, thanks to the listeners, because if you don't listen, we can't do this. And that's it. That is it for 2019. That is it for the decade. We'll be back with another show on January 8, 2020. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thank you for listening.